Welcome to Senior Living, brought to you by OWL Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Chrissy Mernon. During the next half hour, I'm reading articles from AARP, the magazine. The story is The Hero Within, A Rampaging Bear, A Deadly Fire, A Murderous Gunman, and More. How we find the courage to step up big when facing life or death risk, by David Hockman. William Ayotte fought off a bear with a shovel. In 2013, Ayotte, then 69, battled a polar bear that was savagely mauling a woman in Manitoba, Canada. It was 5 a.m. when I heard somebody screaming, "Help! It's a bear!" I opened my front door, and there was a 275-pound polar bear sitting on its haunches with a woman in its mouth, waving her around like a rag doll. I thought to myself, I've got no weapon or anything. Then I saw my shovel sitting there and found myself going to get it. Once I picked it up, I thought, well, am I going to do anything, or is that woman going to die? So down the steps I went. When I got over there, I stepped up and hit the bear in the eye. I'd heard this is the best way to fight a bear. He let go of the woman, and she ran into my house. The bear reached out for and grabbed a hold of me, and the mauling was on. He tore off my right ear, and I was waiting for him to bite me again. A neighbor fired a shotgun, but it didn't do any good. So he jumped into his truck and gunned it toward us. I was on my belly on the ground watching this vehicle speeding our way, and it stopped about 2 feet away before the bear let me go. I spent 7 days in the hospital. They worked on me for 4 hours one day to staple my wounds, and then for 4 hours the next day, putting my ear back on. So I came out of it pretty good. I never saw myself as a hero and still don't. You're dealt a situation and you either respond or you don't do anything. People say, would you have done anything differently? I haven't the faintest idea. The only thing I could think was, if I don't do anything, she's not going to make it. My hero. Thank you will never be enough. He gave me life. It's the most remarkable thing a person can do. Risk his life for another human being, a stranger. Aaron Green, attack victim. Kemal Agass saved a woman from drowning. In the fall of 2007, Agass, then 65, rescued a swimmer in Florida. It was a gorgeous morning on Cocoa Beach when these green-black clouds rolled in and the water got very choppy. I am a photographer and was staring at what was almost an artistic scene. Suddenly, this guy on the beach started yelling, my wife, she's in the ocean and can't get out. I was born and raised in the sea in my country, Albania, and we used to go to the beach almost all summer, every day, for hours and hours. In other words, I know how tides work from a lifetime of swimming in them. This was a rip current, which meant the tide takes you out fast but fights you from swimming back in. Another man I'd never met before, a great big guy around 50 years old, jumped into the water with me and we swam straight to the lady. We got right out there. I knew from getting caught in a tide like this when I was 13 or 14 that you have to swim back at an angle, not directly toward shore. But it was still hard swimming. We told the lady, she was in her late 60s, to swim next to us and stay calm, to follow me and press my shoulder if she needed help. You don't want someone hanging on you. They can pull you under when they're afraid of drowning. But she was swimming okay. Meanwhile, the ocean was getting rougher and rougher. The woman and I swam at an angle to shore, but the other man got separated. We couldn't see him. This is the worst part. By the time the rescue team got to him, it was too late. He died trying to save a woman he never met. The experience changed me. The man who drowned was a father with two kids. For a long while, I couldn't get his death out of my mind. At the same time, the woman is alive. We've become friends. It reminds me every day to be optimistic about life and especially to try to do good things with the brief time we have to be good. My hero. This was a terrible experience. Somebody died, but somebody was saved, and it's because Kemal didn't think I could get hurt. That's who he is, Flora Agash, Kemal's wife. Donnie Navadad caught a falling woman. In 2013, Navadad, then 61, saved a woman who toppled from a football stadium in Oakland, California. My friend and I were at the Coliseum to see the Raiders play the Tennessee Titans. After the game, as we were heading out, someone's phone fell and smashed near us, and then a bunch of people started pointing up. There was a woman up there on the edge of the railing. I turned to Glenn and said, "Do you think she's going to jump?" He said, "Oh boy, she's falling as we speak." It's about a four-story drop from where she fell, and without thinking, I just put my arms out as she came toward me. Listen, I was in the Marines, and even though that was 40-some years ago, I still think like a Marine. Fortunately, I still react like one once in a while. She leveled out flat as she hit my arms and bounced off me and fell about 4 feet away. I fell to the ground, too, from the impact, and I blacked out for a minute. When I came to, Glenn was holding up fingers and saying, "How many do you see?" I was okay. The woman was alive but was in a coma for a while and had brain surgery. She later told me she was very grateful. They call her Miracle Girl. But what bothered me was that I didn't do a better job of saving her. I couldn't really latch on to her. My hero. Donnie's seen a lot. S blank blank T doesn't scare him. Many people would turn away if they saw 100 pounds dropping down on them, but he just saved her life. Glenn Israel, friend. Shirley White saved neighbors from a wildfire. White, then 85, helped preserve the Montecito Heights area of Santa Rosa, California from a fire in October 2017. The crash woke me up. Just after midnight on a very windy Sunday last October, I heard a very loud noise, and it was a large fir tree falling into my yard from the neighbor's yard. It crushed a greenhouse and took down the tip of a power line as it landed. I'd been in my house almost 50 years and know how much damage wind and trees can do, but as I was coming downstairs and glanced outside, I was horrified to see brilliant flames outside my window way up over my head. I live alone. My husband died 6 years ago, and I thought, I have to call 911, but there was no time. I thought, this could go everywhere. It could burn the whole hill. I threw on something over my nightgown, raced outside, grabbed a hose, and started spraying water as hard as I could. The wind had already spread the flames to a live oak and then to some blackberry vines on the edge of my driveway. It was really howling now, and I could feel the heat, but I just braced myself and kept on squirting. This must have gone on for 5 minutes, but it felt like an hour. An architect neighbor smelled smoke and ran over to help. Then the couple across the driveway came and someone called the fire department. When the fire trucks arrived, they yelled at us to move back, but I couldn't stop. I said, "We have to keep water on this fire." I had no idea I had done anything special. People I never met were knocking on my front door the next day saying, "You're a hero, you saved the hill." But I was just the first responder. I saw what I saw and I took action. Thousands of people lost everything. That night, in other parts of California, we were fortunate to be spared. But I don't think it was a miracle. The reality is my children weren't there and my husband wasn't there, and if I wanted to stay in the home I loved, I would have to step up. So I did, but then got a lot of help. My hero. I'm 61, and her heroism reminded me of what I already knew. It's not about age, it's about spirit. You're never too old to fight a determined fight. That's from Mark Quattracci, a neighbor. Chased down a mass shooter, Stephen Williford. In November of 2017, Williford, then 55, wounded a gunman who had just murdered 26 people in Sutherland Springs, Texas. I was in my bedroom, relaxing before work on a Sunday morning, when my daughter came in and said she heard gunshots coming from the First Baptist Church down the street. I went and got my firearm from the safe and ran outside without even putting on shoes because I knew every pop, pop, pop might represent someone's life. The shooter came out of the church wearing black tactical gear, saw me right away, and started shooting at me. I returned fire. He hit the truck I was using for cover. He hit the car behind me. He hit the house behind me. I'm a former NRA instructor and competitive shooter, and I'm good with rifles because I trained during most of my adult life. I'd never been in a situation like this and never wanted to be. But let me tell you, those many years of training made a difference. Using a holographic red dot scope, I hit the shooter in a small area not covered by his bulletproof vest. He still managed to get away. He got into his vehicle and fired another couple of rounds through his side window. Someone in a pickup truck at a stop sign witnessed the whole thing, and I tapped on his window and said, "We got to catch this guy." I got in, and the chase was on. As a Christian, I really felt that God was protecting us and guiding us. We were driving just as fast as this guy's truck would move, and we caught up to the shooter. He pulled over and stopped, and as I started to open the door, the shooter accelerated again and hit a road sign before going over a curb into a field. That's when the police say he shot himself. At that point, we had already called 911, and the police arrived 5 minutes later. 26 people were tragically killed, but the survivors can rest easy knowing that this guy won't ever hurt anyone again. People hear this story and think I'm some kind of Rambo. I'm not. I'm the biggest marshmallow in the world. I'm the first person to cry at a sad movie. But you don't mess with my neighbors, my friends, or my family. My hero. Me? I was terrified, but I knew right away that Dad was going to step in. It's not in him to hide. That's just not who he is. That's Stephanie Williford, Stephen Williford's daughter. Jumped into a fight to help a cop, Vicki Williams Tillman. In February 2017, Williams Tillman, then 57, came to the aid of a police officer struggling with a dangerous suspect in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. On a beautiful Sunday morning in February, I was cruising down the street listening to gospel music before church and turned down a little side street. I saw a squad car stopped and a police officer and another man in a scuffle. I rolled down my window and I called out to the officer, "Do you need help?" He nodded, so I called the police and gave the location. But as I waited for them to arrive, I started to worry about the officer, whose name is Billy Aim. A pair of handcuffs dangled from a wrist of the suspect. Officer Billy's nightstick, flashlight, and radio were on the ground. It turned out that before I had gotten there, while other people drove right on past, the suspect had hit Billy on the head with the nightstick. "Are you going to be okay?" I asked him. He didn't answer me, but we locked eyes. His were watery, and I felt mine get watery too. Those eyes said, "Don't leave me." The next thing I knew, I had gotten out of my car and I was gliding toward them like I had on roller skates. It was almost like I wasn't in my body. My mind just went blank and free. I felt so at peace, completely safe, even though I am only 5'2". As I got closer, I saw blood and hair smeared on the cruiser. And then I noticed that both men had a hand on the officer's gun. So I grabbed the suspect's hand on the gun, twisted his arm behind him, and jumped on his back. Officer Billy, who is 6'6", fell on me, and soon we were all down on the ground. I heard sirens, and when I looked up, I saw backup coming. I know some people who say they would never have done what I did, but that is them and not me. One thing about me is that I'm not worried about what people think of me. All I'm worried about is what God thinks of me. My hero. I've been an officer for 22 years and never had anybody help me like that. You don't want to mess with that, grandmother. Billy Aim, Baton Rouge PD. James Bud Garvey pulled a man from a burning car. In November of 2016, Garvey, then 76, rescued a man from a fiery wreck near Imler, Pennsylvania. I own a race car museum 82 miles from where I live. My wife and I go up every Saturday. One morning, we were buzzing along the interstate when I saw smoke ahead. There was fire in a ditch, and I said to my wife, "That looks like a car burning." I got out and scrambled down. There was a fellow sitting in the middle of a burning car. The woods were on fire and flames were all over the front of the vehicle. I hollered to him to come on out. He very calmly said, "I can't." The way he said it was eerie. I knew I was his only hope. I tried the door, but it was jammed. Just then, the front tire blew out and sent me flying backward into the brush. I staggered to the car and saw the guy was losing consciousness. The fire was going to town. I crawled in the window and braced my feet against the door and got a hold of him under his arms, and he came out halfway but was still stuck. I rolled him to the side, and whatever was holding him broke loose. I was still in pretty good shape at 76 and dragged him up the hill to the road. My wife's a retired RN, and she kept him calm until the state police came. I drove race cars. As an amateur pilot, I was in 2 airplane crashes. One time, I landed in a tree and had to climb out. So you can say this was instinct based on a lifetime of experience. Mostly, I knew I couldn't leave this man who turned out to have a couple of young kids there to burn. My hero. When Bud got to the car, I knew he wasn't going to stop until he got this man to safety. He did it almost automatically. I am so proud of him. Nancy Garvey, Bud's wife. The next article from AARP, the magazine, is Personal Best, My Sport. Freestyle. Journalist T.R. Reed discovers a hidden Benny of late-life snowboarding. Our three-man team clambered onto the gondola at the base of the mountain. A young woman on the ski lift looked up at my gray hair, then down at my snowboard boots and made a comment I've heard before. "You're the oldest snowboarder I've ever seen." She had a point. I was born a few weeks ahead of D-Day, but the two friends who were with me are hardly spring chickens either. Dick Zellner is 78, Joe Tasek is 71. We three tend to move from one resort to another. In deciding where to go next, we naturally look for ski areas that offer soaring mountain vistas and a decent bar or two. But we also consider each resort's respect for the elderly, that is, how much of a price break we get. We first discovered this consideration a few years back at a mountain ski resort in New Mexico. As we approached the window to buy our lift tickets, a great day got even greater. A big sign read, 70 and over, ski free. Dick and I easily qualified for the free tickets, but Joe was a mere boy of 68 at the time, so he did not. Naturally, Joe made the argument that we are a team, we call ourselves the Medicare Ski Team, and thus should split the $70 cost of his lift ticket. We voted 2-1 to not do that. We three old friends have been hiking, biking, skiing, and drinking fine wines together for decades now. In summer, we used to climb mountains, but over time, those excursions became too strenuous for our aging joints, despite replacement parts. When snow season comes, though, we're still drawn to the slopes. As I'm zipping through a snowy glade on my board, I feel lucky that we live near the Rocky Mountains and can still enjoy them at our age, but I feel entitled, too. After decades of paying for the privilege, doggone it, we've earned those free lift tickets. Personal best travel shorts. Normandy Invasion 2019. Big crowds will land in France for the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Thousands of tourists will flock to France to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the Allies' massive storming of Normandy's Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944, which led to Germany's defeat in World War II. If you want to be there, too, to check out such iconic sites as Omaha Beach and Pointe du Hoc, better make plans now. Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours will be conducting 15 sold-out historian-led D-Day tours to Normandy for the official ceremonies. They filled up fast, says director Mark Bielski. Normandy will be host to anniversary-related events galore, including a June 5th reenactment with some 250 volunteers parachuting into Normandy from World War II era planes. And the festivities will be especially poignant this year, one of the last that will include veterans who lived through the historic invasion. Personal best, my cause. Anne Marie Riccatelli found comfort and a new purpose in an ancient instrument, the sounds of solace. Late in 2015, I lost my life partner of 43 years. 3 weeks after Hank passed away, I attended Vespers in the Basilica of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, a parish church in New York's Little Italy neighborhood. Even though I had lived just a few blocks away for nearly 50 years, I had never been inside the old cathedral before. As I sat in the pew, I heard the sound of heavenly thunder emitting from an enormous organ. I was astonished. I really felt that I was being pulled from the depths of my grief and comforted from another realm. After the service, I asked about the organ and learned it was made in 1868 by the greatest organ builder of his time, Henry Urban, specifically for the Basilica. It was one of the most important historical instruments in the nation, but was badly deteriorated. It was being kept alive by Jared Lomenzo, the Basilica's organist, a master musician and Harvard-trained engineer who sometimes had to make repairs on the fly in the middle of a service. Restoration would cost $2 million. I wanted to make a donation to help, but the person I spoke with said the parish was looking for a single donor because raising the funds from small donations would be too time-consuming. The church needed to focus its energies and resources on helping people and keeping its building in good repair. As the weeks unfolded, whenever grief overtook me, I thought of the organ. I never imagined that a musical sound from the 19th century could have such healing power. I phoned the parish a few times to find out how the search for a donor was going. They were having no luck. One day, the following summer, I had a chance meeting with a retired attorney from Maine. When he told me he was also a philanthropist, I told him about the organ, and he advised me to set up a nonprofit corporation to attract money from individuals and foundations. The next day, I told the pastor of the basilica about this meeting. He became very serious and said, "I have a sense that divine providence is at work here. Look into this." So I did. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but committed people from the church were already in place. Together, we would figure it out. The first year, we established Friends of the Urban Organ, which received a big boost at the end of 2017 when movie director Martin Scorsese, who went to church at the Basilica as a boy, invited his friends to contribute to the organ in honor of his 75th birthday. With $250,000 in hand, we are 12.5% of the way toward our goal. We have planned a variety of fundraisers. When we get to $2 million, the restoration can begin. This work has taught me that if an important task is presented to me, I must say yes, even if I feel wholly inadequate about accomplishing it. Hank told me that the phrase, "Nothing is impossible to a willing heart," described me perfectly. It describes this project, too. My personal best, my winter comfort. Deep dish devotion. For the novelist Debbie McComber, cooking means creativity and family. In my kitchen, I have a little octagon-shaped turret, and its shelves are filled with cookbooks. I must have about 200. In front of those is my mother's cardboard recipe holder from the 1940s, when she was a young wife, and next to that is the green tin recipe box I used in high school home ec. Some of my mother's recipes are in my box, and I've passed along some of my recipes to my daughters and daughters-in-law. Food is love and appreciation, but it's also a way of connecting one generation to the next. Still, you have to keep things fresh. I love experimenting in the kitchen. For me, creativity is for all of life. It's not just for when I sit down to write. A few years ago, my husband Wayne and I took a vacation to Ireland, and I was amazed at how different Guinness beer tastes there because it's unpasteurized. Wayne loves Guinness, and I love pot pies, so when we got back home, I decided to combine the two, and I think I created the perfect cozy winter dish. The heroine of my new book is a sous chef in Alaska, and I can see her tucking into this Guinness pot pie on a frigid evening. Of course, she'd make hers with moose meat, not beef. Wayne and I raised 4 kids together. Now it's just the two of us at home, but I still haven't broken the habit of cooking for 6, so this is a generous recipe. Fortunately, my daughter stops by almost every day, and she gets some of the leftovers. Who knows? Maybe one day one of my grandkids will be cooking this dish. Debbie McComber, 70, has written dozens of novels. The latest is Alaskan Holiday, as well as Debbie McComber's Table, from which this recipe came. The next article from AARP, the magazine, is What Comes After? AARP members responded passionately to essays that address two of the most viral issues of 2018. Here's what happened. The Me Too movement. You were stupid. Journalist Robin Western made the shocking revelation of her long-ago rape in our June-July issue. She brings us up to date on readers' responses and the blurring effect of the Kavanaugh hearing. 6 months ago, my Me Too moment appeared in this magazine. In that article, I described a terrible incident, being raped during the summer I worked as a receptionist at a New York City law firm. For 50 years, I kept my violent assault a secret. That is, until the Me Too movement, with its chorus of outrage, gave me the courage to speak out. After the article's publication, other silences were broken, too. Dozens of readers shared their stories with me, some for the first time, revealing accounts of rape and sexual assaults committed on the job, in doctors' and professors' offices, on massage tables, at houses of worship, and while they were on dates. More than once, I was brought to tears by the pain and trauma described in their writing. I hoped that by unlocking their own dark secrets, they could in some way find healing, though I know from experience it isn't easy and it isn't always possible. Readers' reactions were overwhelmingly uplifting, expressing sympathy and appreciation that I had come forward, and I'm grateful for that support. That said, there were also a few angry and mean-spirited reader reactions. Some blamed me for not knowing my rapist's intention before I got into his car. Others accused me of lying, boistering their claim by pointing out that I hadn't told anyone what had happened. One reader wrote, "You were stupid for going back to your job the next day." The writer either missed how powerless and frightened I felt as a naive 19-year-old, or maybe she simply didn't care. Another woman's comment was so heartless that I'm still working on finding forgiveness. "Most stories like this are unbelievable," she wrote. "As if that weren't enough," she added, "one should always dress and behave as you wish to be addressed. By nature, I'm a pretty mellow person, but to finally muster the courage to speak out about my rape and then to be mocked, or worse, not be believed, well, that's when my fury took hold. Let me be crystal clear. It did happen to me, and sexual assault is never deserved." Some wondered if it was even worth revealing the attack so many years later. "She is now speaking out much too late, so why bother?" wrote Maureen D. of Owings, Maryland, in a letter to the editor. Bruce M. posted on Facebook, "Took you 50 years, forget about it." Yes, wow. Similarly, a couple of readers questioned why I hadn't named names. Identifying him, they responded, would help other victims speak out and would give the rapist the justice he deserved. I get it. Before turning in the original article, I did contemplate outing my attacker. Considering how smoothly he orchestrated his attack, which included the cooperation of his chauffeur, I also suspected I wasn't his only victim. After the piece came out, I felt inspired by 70-year-old Joni Caldwell from Monterey, California. "I had been plagued for the last 30 years because I hadn't reported my abuser," she wrote me. "I recently filed a report with the police, who responded kindly and with compassion. Still, I had a rough day afterward. But now, weeks later, I feel more complete for having done it." In a follow-up phone call, she told me, "I'm much closer to closing the book on my sexual assault." A quick online search has confirmed that my rapist is long gone. He died more than a dozen years ago. Even if I had decided to identify him, when a rapist is dead, there's no legal recourse. It's over. More important, I don't want to cause suffering to any of his innocent living relatives, especially grown children or grandchildren. There's enough pain in the world. And I believe that how much to disclose is up to the victim. While generations raised on social media may feel free to tell all, those of us over age 50 tend to draw a sharper line between what we keep private and what we share. So I chose and choose not to identify him. These varied reactions from readers are largely proof of how far we have come toward recognizing the depth of the issue of sexual harassment and assault. Even the harshest commentators, it seems, did not quibble with an unassailable truth that any kind of sexual assault is wrong. And we have made great progress. I have welcomed the unearthing of assaults and harassment and the consequences, from criminal charges, Harvey Weinstein, to social and corporate banishment, Mario Batali. Our laws and even prosecutors have evolved to protect victims more, thanks to revelations like Joni's and mine. Every woman of my vintage knows what sexual harassment is, although we didn't have a name for it, said Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in January 2018. In the case of 85-year-old Justice Ginsburg, it was a college professor who behaved inappropriately more than six decades ago. "For so long, women were silent, thinking there was nothing you could do about it," she said. "But now the law is on the side of women or men who encounter harassment, and that's a good thing." I would go so far as to say we are poised to radically transform the workplace and relations generally between men and women, that we are at a societal inflection point. But lately we have hit roadblocks to that broader enlightenment, like the scandal that enveloped the actress Asia Argento, an early leader in the movement who was recently accused of sexual assault of a minor. And then came the confirmation hearing of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. What had been an issue on which nearly all Americans could agree became so infused with politics that it has now, I worry, set back our movement. Don't get me wrong. I watched, rapt, as Christine Blasey Ford testified, and I knew exactly what she struggled with over these many years, the fear, the embarrassment, and the shame that continue to traumatize her. I, too, experienced the way sexual assault infects its victim's life with anxiety and puts a limit on maneuvering freely in the world. I watched her fight back tears, and I shed many of my own. The context of her testimony at that point, however, was no longer personal or even societal. It was political, a great no-holds-barred debate and bloodletting, Democrats versus Republicans, conservatives versus liberals. All that vitriol only serves to obscure the point of the Me Too movement and the very real pain of women who have been assaulted, slowing their progress on every front. So let's keep our eye on the ball and focus on what unites, not divides us. Join me in continuing to tell our stories and speak out against pervasive sexism and violence against women, whether we do this publicly or confidentially, with a therapist, friend, partner, or stranger. As long as we find the strength to release our truth in the way that feels right for each of us, we can all move forward. There is no turning back. Thanks for listening to today's Senior Living. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program will be replayed after 9 this evening. I'm Chrissy Mernon, saying goodbye from AL Radio.